This is Karen Musgrave. I'm doing the Quilters SOS Save Our Stories interview with Duncan Slade. Today's date is October 20th, 2008. It is now 12:35 in the afternoon. And we are in, what town in Maine are we in?
Westport Island.
Westport Island, Maine. I should have asked that before we started. And I want to thank you for taking time out of your day to do this with me. And I would like you to tell me about Northwood Suite Waterfall that you selected for the interview.
Okay. This quilt is part of a suite of seven pieces. It's a commissioned piece. The work was, we were commissioned by Nuveen, John Nuveen, Inc., in Chicago, Illinois, to do a lobby area in their office building. The building was built in 1983, and we had done some work for them earlier on, and so we got to know the principals of the corporation. It was a corporation looking for a new space initially because they had to move out of a building, a historic building in Chicago, the Rookery, and so they started commissioning new art for a new space. So people like Jim Dine and I'm going to blank on everybody else, but artists were commissioned and we got an early small commission. And that relationship with that corporation led us to, 10 years later, being asked to do a new lobby area. And so Waterfall was part of that seven-piece suite. It sits at the end of a corridor, so it can be viewed from a great deal of length, which made some decisions about what we could include in it because we were concerned about how people would view it from a distance, wanting them to pretty much comprehend it from that distance and not be surprised when they get up close. Although there's a great amount of detail in it, and so we are trying to hold their interest once they do get up close to it. The cascading waterfall is pretty much based on the waterfall at Watkins Glen, New York, and we spent time at that waterfall when we did another commission for a collector by the name of Jack Walsh. And so the idea of looking at water, watching it fall, seeing the patterns that are made, seeing that you cannot photograph a waterfall of any length because of the speed that the water takes. And so there was an exploration into that pattern and how to make it look like a waterfall but not truly photographic waterfall, which will be stopped in one area, either at the top or at the bottom, depending upon the speed of the film, and then blur out the rest, and how to break that up and how to execute it. It was a little bit of a diversion from our normal format of putting the landscape element in, which it pretty much seems to be constant in our work, and yet there are exceptions to that, and this piece probably for some people seems to be an exception in that it doesn't have a middle distance or far distance landscape as a component, but as much as that's a dictate that seems to occur in all our work, it's in most of our work. And so not all of it. So this piece certainly is well within the parameters of what we do. The idea also here was to, since we were in a dark glen where the light is very limited, the idea of doing elaborate rocks, I mean, it was far more interesting to us to have the rock fall over the pattern, or the waterfall over the pattern, rather than see that waterfall separate from the pattern. It started out as a small thumbnail drawing. We actually did sketches of the configuration of the pattern and how the waterfall would fit in that pattern. That was probably 4 inches by 4 inches, just little sketches on how this idea would evolve. And at the time that we presented it to Nuveen for their review before signing the contract for the commission, I believe we executed it as a work on paper. The pattern areas were done using a color Xerox and assembling the patterns and then overpainting, and the waterfall would have been hand painted on the paper. And I believe that was probably about 15 by 15. So that by the time we started working on this piece, it was fairly well decided upon about how the piece would look, the basics of it. We knew that the pattern would be printed flat and that the side panels that appear to stand forward are actually an illusion where it's just using shading by overpainting with the fiber reactive dyes makes it appear to come forward, although the pattern itself sits flat. And so we could execute Xerox components for our maquette that we could manipulate to decide on the configuration of the pattern. The pattern itself is made of a single element of the pattern in the quilt is from a drawing of draped fabric, and that little square of draped fabric is used in a standard grid repeat, and it expands outward, and if you look for it, you can find it, and the pattern begins to take its shape. So it was important early on that nobody would see shapes appearing in there that would suggest something that was either negative or anything, because if you look carefully, there is a swastika appearing in the pattern, as many diagonal emphasis quilt patterns can elicit that shape. So it's concealed in there, and it wasn't important. The most important thing in doing it was setting up the pattern so that your eye wouldn't find the pattern being static. So it's off-center from right to left. If you look at what appears to be a triangle on either side, right or left, they aren't parallel, symmetrical, and was to get that revolution forming so that the background has keeps your eye moving. The waterfall has its own pull up and down and balanced with the horizontal water at the bottom and sky at the top. While we were executing this piece, there was another concern between accepting the commission and the execution of it. The World Trade Center came down in New York. If, in fact, the viewers of this quilt ever saw the World Trade Center in the columns, then we felt that was all they were ever going to see. And we actually delayed the installation of the work for a period of time without saying anything to the client and just hoping that that image would not be the key thing they saw in the piece. And those are things that we understand about pattern and design, that if we can premeditate that something that carries weight and is important to somebody, we know it's going to take on an emotion in the piece for them. So if that emotion, if it doesn't belong to us, if it's not that important to the piece in general, then we need to make sure that that's not what we're communicating, that what we intend to communicate is what is going to happen, at least to some extent. You know, you can't control that because you don't know what's going to happen in the future, what those shapes are going to mean. But at least initially, it was a difficult time for everybody in this country, and we didn't think that this quilt needed that emphasis, and hope that they enjoyed it for a variety of other reasons besides that. After a lifetime of silk screening pattern and then hand applying color to shade, this pretty much follows the same idea in terms of the pattern area. This pattern area was executed using digital printing. And the whole idea was that after 30 some odd years of pulling a squeegee over a silk screen and bringing that to quilt making, which it wasn't part of the quilt making tradition in general, although there are plenty of examples of applying color to quilts throughout history. When we discovered that attempts were being made to push the same colors we had been hand painting with and hand silk screening with, for 30 years when there was attempts to push it through an inkjet printer, we weren't afraid of it. It was our medium, it was our colors, and we needed to know how it worked and whether it was going to be a benefit to us as artists or not. And so we did tell the corporation we were going to employ some digital work in this, and basically we just simply told them just the same way that digital technology revolutionized the way they did their business in terms of business machinery, computers for transmitting data and doing banking. It was changing our world as well. So Nuveen's project was the first time we did an elaborate project putting color on the surface using inkjet technology with fiber reactive dyes. We elected not to do a lot of shading because we didn't trust color modulation. We knew it would put down flat colors well. And so we employed that. We employed some components for the waterfall in terms of dropping the background out of the fabric so that the white in the waterfall is the white of the fabric, although close inspection of the quilt, you find some discharge. And we also used application of wax so that we could paint either by, and we could paint and we could pull color out, or we could use a resist so we could paint and let elements of that water up at the top of the waterfall. There's a light mist, and that was created by splattering paraffin wax off a toothbrush and then over painting, so that that soft mist that falls off the top of the waterfall, when you get up really close, you can begin to feel that soft mist. I'm going from different components here and just kind of explaining things as I'm looking at the drawing of it. Painting the waterfall itself, I'll elaborate a little more and just say that what we did is just like a photographer will, or a newspaper or anybody printing can go into a digital file and overlay one thing and drop what's behind it out. That's how we did an 8-foot tall painting of the waterfall on black paper, photographed it, transferred it so we could overlay the pattern. So when we got our fabric in the studio and began painting, the basic color was on the fabric of the pattern. No shading was in that area at all. And the waterfall was in a very, very rough, very low resolution form because we blew it up so big. But you can see the white. What we did is used digital printing to actually create a resist so we could have water falling over colored fabric. I will say that once that waterfall was in our studio, it was on a, mounted on a panel, and we began painting. I say we because Gail and I work together. And the one thing about the we is we never reveal who did what, but we never paint over each other's hand. So in this case, this piece was, we can discuss and we go on. This piece was in the studio for, the waterfall itself was well over a month of studying what was happening because we've never seen one, a drawing of a waterfall this big before. And there were a lot of decisions. So we weren't going on turf that we were comfortable with, that we were familiar to us. And we were making decisions all along about what it needed to be. What did you need to see when you were close? What did you need to see when you were far away from it? Knowing that the viewer in the corridor where it was going to be.
And we should say that this is 77 by 77.
Yeah, the quilt itself is 77. Yeah, thank you. 77 by 77. In actual execution, because digital printing at this particular time, the biggest printer we had access to and was 60 inches wide, so it was executed in three panels and then cut and pieced together. And it was easy enough to cut and piece it in obvious breaks. So you'll find the seam along the inside edge of the patterned area on either side of the sky, at the top. You'll follow that straight down. Actually, it was cut and pieced around the water at the bottom so that we didn't put a seam in a detailed area. It was easy enough to piece that in three panels. It also allowed for a lot of the hand quilting and machine quilting to be done in smaller pieces. When we're quilting, I'm going to move on right to quilting. Let me just finish up and say that, I'll reiterate and say that it is basically conceived of as a unified piece, even though our general operating procedure is to create illusions of being collaged, playing with particularly like the illusion of the water in the foreground at the base of the waterfall appears to be in front of the pattern. And we do that. It appears to be cut and pieced, but in fact we execute as much as we can on a single piece. So that we like to say that it's the way we think about creating a piece is a collaged method, but that we basically cut and paste cerebrally. We do a lot of that. I think the development of our work was from silk screening, initially paper. So we have design concepts coming from our own education, being educated in the late 60s, early 70s. The kind of work that we looked at when we were young artists, the kind of imagery we were initially interested in. We like to say that as much as we have never really made a traditional quilt, much of our design work really, I think, it has to be assessed honestly that we have always paid tradition to the traditional tradition of quilting in the way we approach things. We don't always execute it the way a traditional quilt maker would. A traditional quilt maker might have craft concerns about the size of their stitch, and then that may be purely an aesthetic thing. In some cases, a traditional quilt maker needed to make their stitches small enough so that it wouldn't fetch up on your bed clothing. And as an artist, we have the luxury not to be concerned with those concerns. So that while we address the form and the function of the tradition, we'd like to say we have the luxury as artists to play with that vocabulary and take it. So that's a long meandering way of talking about why the foreground seems to jump forward, but we wanted that proof. Since weren't putting a traditional landscape in, that allowed the push and pull of foreground to background, we allowed the base of this piece to jump forward, therefore allowing the other part of the piece to set back from it. Quilting, I think I was moving on to quilting. Most of our pieces are machine and hand quilted, and we always have considered the machine line to be a hard line. We use it to perimeter pattern components. So if you approach this piece up close, you will find that the squares, which are set on a diamond in this piece, and they're in here. They're coming that way. I'm going to, just for Karen's gratification, I'm going to show her where the repeat component is in the pieces. And so we'll perimeter those repeat components, let them be visible, identified up close, and it'll help the viewer to locate the repeat component. And that sunken line between the pieces will at times confuse people, make them assume that it was pieced. And that's our pleasure to fool the eye. We come from a long tradition, I think, in art where trompe-l'oeil work and, if you go back to medieval manuscript illumination, which we always cite as a source for inspiration, you will find the scribe putting a self-portrait of himself in a border, reaching outside the framed box of his own compartment in the illustration and reaching with his ink pen out and down the page to a bottle of ink below. And that breaking of literal picture plane and illusion, those are all component parts. So we always see ourselves as, when we're drawing, we see our drawings not as anything static, but something that we can either cut up or reach from one part into the other. But I was talking about quilting. So I'll just finish up and say that when we talk about hand stitching, we talk about a soft line, and that's something that we traditionally do is put a scrim of thread, parallel lines, and circular lines, but basically concentric or parallel lines as a scrim over the surface when we're serving the purpose of tying the three layers together. And we're also, it allows us to punch with color sometimes, so that in this particular piece there are some metallic threads and different colored threads running down the waterfall. You up on real close inspection, you'll find a variety of color. We know that just a thin red line of thread over a green field, that you can modify the color of the fabric by changing the colored thread that you overlay it with. Those are lessons we learned as young art students, how to modify color by either budding it with another color or how color functions that way. It is amazing how much you can modify the color of a piece of fabric with little bits of thread on top of it. But, and we've used that in certain other pieces.
I want you to talk about the we. Because I think the we...
In context of this.
We
missed that in the beginning.
Yeah, and I think we need to talk about the we.
Probably should do it. Since 1975, myself as a person with a social security card, Duncan W. Slate, and Gail Frost, we have, since 1975, neither one of us have ever signed a piece of art, whether it be a quilt or work on paper or other things. Since we started working together, we have always signed all our work Frost Slate. We generally put a dot between the two, but it's just graphic. And we've done that out of respect for what we initially felt we were on, which was a quest. It was a quest that we felt we shared, and it's a quest to figure out what was the best of us, I think. And I think that's very much an individual quest, and there's no mistaking that both of us would say we were lucky enough to find something that we could work on with somebody else and have the joys of what working together with somebody means. This has worked for over 30 years where neither of us have ever felt subservient to the other, and it's just been an interesting way to work. Both of us would say, honestly, if that relationship, our marriage, or if for any reason something happened to one of us, probably neither one of us would go looking for somebody else to work with, but would continue to be an artist, but would continue the work unabated, and the work would continue. It would go on with just one of us or us individually. It just doesn't. That's just known by us, and we just know that that's the way we would proceed in life. We found a way of working, and the way we describe it is a vocabulary of working. It's a vocabulary that we feel we, you know, pieced together from the greater world around us. We went from being more urban art students to living a rural life of looking at art history and having our own likes in 19th century landscape painting. And I've already mentioned things. We grew up in a pop art tradition, and then we came to working with textile techniques, including the traditional ones. Gail was also interested in weaving and did a lot of weaving, and I was interested in silk screen. and transferring imagery to fabric, and through those tools, we found a voice and have created a body of work that satisfies us and has allowed us the luxury of having an existence as artists in a culture that has been accepting of the kind of work we've been doing. So that's worked real well for us. We work in a studio that's a renovated barn. It's been our studio since 1987. If one of us is not in the studio, usually the other one is, and there are lots of days where we're in there together. There's some days where it's not big enough for both of us, and that's always a negotiated plan of attack. But what we do is there are times where one person does need to be alone to work, and there are times where there's a big job where it does take two people to manage handling materials and stuff. So that's all just give and take on how that works. We wear separate hats mostly when it comes to finishing the work. Gail's the quilter in terms of making decisions. I get a lot of decision input into how certain things will work with the quilting, but we negotiate it out, and she does most of the quilting, but I do mounting and framing because most of our work is small enough. Even the 77 by 7, this piece here, the waterfall piece, we were able to do a welded aluminum frame for it and plexiglass over the front. Our concern with framing quilts is that, one, it be archival, and that we create an environment where that piece can live. Early on, we saw the Esprit collection and consulted with Julie Silber about how we were framing our quilts, because we saw, even in a corporate space where people are dressed nice and wear nice clothes and behave nicely and it's a nice environment, that that damage can be done to a textile surface. We're making something that, while it can last a very, very long time properly protected, it became apparent that a collector is spending money, that as the maker, it was partly our responsibility to ensure them that, and assist them in making good choices about protecting that investment, and that we would be doing ourselves in the larger world of art a disservice if the piece was damaged and couldn't be repaired. So framing has always been an interest and concern. So we've done a lot of work developing new things with framing as well, in terms of how we mount and how we frame and how we keep that environment archival. I have pointed out on many occasions that many of the great 19th century quilts we have to look at today, we have, in fact, because they've been in storage and were either just tops that were never completed or were completed and put in trunks. And, in fact, the one saving grace on those pieces is that they were lined with paper that was a low-sulfur paper and the right glue, because ultimately those quilts wouldn't exist if that paper and that glue weren't being used at that time. So, again, we learn new things over time, but ultimately they're great materials for framing. We like when a quilt is, generally what we do is we stretch a panel of linen on a wooden frame that's been sealed, and once we stretch that linen, we will stitch the quilt to that. We'll first pin it and square the quilt. We won't be so concerned about getting it perfect because it is a quilt and there are variations in the shape. We want the view, but we want it to balance on inside the rigid square of the frame. And so we want it to look good. So we're making decisions about how much negative space. A good framer is making decisions about how wide a mat should be. So we're making those kind of decisions. In the past few years, there have been crazy times where I've milled and finished my own frame stock. Right now we're working with powder-coated welded aluminum, which is pretty contemporary looking for our work, but it's a nice, clean, simple look that doesn't jump out and allows the quilt to show. So that's what seems in quilt, you know, framing is, preferences in framing changed over time. Hopefully the work looks good, whatever frame you put in. We like to say about framing that it's a jumping off point if need be. It's a decision we get involved in that the style of the frame is how the quilt will live in the room, so that, you know, there are times where something specific might be of interest.
So why quilt?
Why quilt?
Yeah.
Well, there's lots of stories that we could say about how we ended up quilting. One of them is that Gail had interest in making things and was interested in weaving and couldn't, and she'll tell this story, couldn't learn enough about weaving quick enough but wanted to do some quilts. So basically, as undergraduates, she came and asked me if I could print on fabric, and I'm not sure 100% what she was thinking at the time, and I was interested in the technical ends of printmaking as well as the kind of imagery that it created. This would have been in the mid-career Andy Warhol era. So we were seeing images, and I had a long-standing fascination with high contrast imagery. Silkscreen was just the perfect tool for that. Ultimately, as soon as a silkscreen printing on paper requires you be able to control a registration. So there's two stories here. One is, as a student and pulling an edition of prints, the one thing you get to do is you get to sign those prints, and what you do is line up those individual pieces of paper with the image on it and sign them. And it was always more interesting to me seeing the repetition of those images as I was signing them. That was as exciting as what I was actually doing as a student at the time. There was another phenomenon, which is with a silk screen, the way we would set up our silk screens as students was with a couple of hinges, so the screen could be lifted and lowered, the paper could be put under the screen, and that was our method of keeping the screen going in the same spot so we could control multicolor registration. So the besides loving pattern, as seen in the repeated images of the paper, there was something absolutely crazy the day that I pulled those hinge pins and realized I could take that silk screen and on a larger surface, I could position it wherever I wanted. And so the release of that rigid format of printing controlled, signed, numbered edition, which I was good at. I could register well. I could handle all the technical stuff. And I liked making that kind of imagery. There was something, there were trumpets going off when those hinge pins came out, and I could go onto a larger surface. So in our early work, it was mostly about what we could control with the silk screen and then what we needed to do to complete the piece. The evolution went to the point where there were certain things that we couldn't do because it got crazy making one silk screen to make one image. We would draw with pen and ink on clear film and then do a photographic process to get that image onto the fabric. So the number of steps the technology was creating was too cumbersome for the imagery. It was a great way to create sharp, hard edges on fabric. So ultimately, reaching a point at which we felt comfortable first by hand coloring our silk screened images, and then ultimately giving up the silk screen for some or all of the whole image and just simply sitting there and doing the work. Because if I could go to work in the morning and sit there with a brush in my hand and have the job done by the end of the day, and if I was going to set up a silk screen and have to make four or five silk screens to do it, it was going to take a week just to set it up. And so it got, find the right tool for the job, find the right technique. Working with fiber reactive dyes, I question was about how did we start quilting, and I'd say that both the two components come together. One of the reasons we tried lots of different art materials developed for fabric, and we did a lot of different things with fabric in the beginning. The first 5 years, probably it looked like there was no cohesiveness to the work we were doing. We were exploring all sorts of materials and ideas. Fiber reactive dyes had been around since the company will tell you they were around since the 50s, made available to artists in the 60s, some interesting stuff done with them, and ultimately, there's a lot of really interesting stuff being done with the dyes now. In terms of manipulating the dyes, nobody has ever bothered trying to follow us in doing as tight a controlled hand painting as we do, and probably that's in part that we live a rural life. We live in a place where we like what we see. We chose to be where we are in Maine because we like sitting in the studio and looking out the window in all the seasons. We like going out, and our excuse for going out kayaking or hiking up a hill or a thing is because we're working. That's our job. And so we do it. If we travel, we're looking for things that play into what we're doing. So whether it's pattern elements in tile floor in Tuscany, or out in the desert southwest, hiking up in the saguaro cactus, it's going to make its way into our work. Did I finish? That was about...
Yeah, you're doing better.
I'm running on. Where do you want to go next?
How long have you remembered?
I've always had two thoughts about how the art world works. And ultimately, I know that if you're the only one that does it, you're an eccentric. If they copy you, emulate you, if you have students, then you're the founder of a movement. So I would say that right now, as I look at, I don't know how the larger art world will judge us. We know we fell out of primary art concepts for the period of time we live on the planet, and that in some ways our mindset situates us much better in the 19th century for our imagery than it does in the 20th century. But you can't control that because times will change again, and so 100 years from now we might look like somebody will find a timeline. So you don't control any of that. We've been concerned enough. I mean, we're vain enough, I think. We've been concerned enough that we've attempted to do a good enough job to keep enough documentation that if somebody did think of what, if this effort that we have pursued was worthy, that we've given them enough paper trail and imagery that we've tried to keep a good photographic record until the digital revolution, everything. We have a whole history of work photographed 4x5 chromes and at a great expense to us over time. Just feeling that it was, the quest was worth documenting at least. Because the other thing about us is we haven't had the luxury to just make art and not worry about it and just let it stockpile for some curator to find. We've had to sell what we've made. That's how we've made majority of our living, so that if we knew we needed to be able to, once every 5 to 10 years, you kind of have to go back to the beginning and go, how did we get here? What was important then? What's important now? Just kind of get your feet back, refocus. It's not always a pretty picture to look back at your own chronology, but once in a while you have to do that. Once in a while we have to go find something we did because we'll be doing something now and you'll realize it feels familiar, and so you need to research your own past history with something. to understand how it, why it's playing out currently. Being remembered. So ultimately, I think the other component part here is, in terms of the quilt world, I think that there is that thing that we've taught a lot, and there are a lot of people who've tried to dive. We've taught Haystack and Penland and certain institutions. We've shown up when quilting guilds have asked us and tried to be as accommodating, and we've watched the evolution of quilt groups being primarily traditional to a great many of them being far more accepting of contemporary things and enjoying making their own fabrics to work with and exploring things. But we also have, and so we watched the evolution opening up with and having been involved with the art quilt in the mid-80s that Penny McMorris and Michael Kyle curated. Starting there, the acceptance of art quilts as a term, I've had an uneasy relationship with that term, but accepting of it because it's what else are you gonna do? And my point being that we've also, while that door opened for us to accept what a contemporary quilt is, we've watched the quilt world put parameters and tighten that definition down to sometimes where we don't meet the criteria. So while we opened that door because we were involved in the New American Quilt exhibit in 1975, we've watched this history. So while we were there in the beginning and saw that door open and were part of what an artist handling a traditional medium brought to it, we've also watched that parameter kind of get narrowed. And so we've always said we were really happy always sitting on the sidelines of most of that. And we've always felt like we would let our work be the primary thing that represented us. So while I've had strong opinions at different times, and consider Michael James, a good friend, I've pointed out to Michael on more than one occasion that the quilt world didn't need two men telling them what to do. So I pretty much tried to not let our voice. We wrote an article for Surface Magazine. We'll go into those things. When there's something important, we'll do it. As I've already expressed our concerns about archival qualities, wrote an article for Surface Design about intent and so the concerns that I had. And so we basically wrote an article to point out that if you're using transient materials, be honest about it when you're trying to sell it. We were making the point that most old Victorian houses somewhere in the attic or basement have old green canvas window shades because our Victorian forebears, if they had bought a sofa, they wanted it to last a lifetime and not fade out. You know, we build these houses with big windows and bright light walls, and we do all these things, and then we expect our art. So I know a lot about UV, plexi, and all that stuff because I felt it has been important to learn that stuff because I need to be able to sell these things. So, yeah, I'd say, how do we fit in? I used to joke, and considering the hierarchy in the contemporary quilt world, some people see that hierarchy and assume that hierarchy will stay constant over time. And to some extent, the people who do good record keeping will have their place because if you get in certain books now, those are going to be the books that future researchers are going to find. So, we won't be accepted as one of the dominant people in this time frame. But I'd like to think that we fit in there. Somebody will discover us or find us more interesting than a lot of the other stuff that gets more airplay right at the present time. Probably there's certain qualities to that because there are certain shows that we don't tend to be interested. We did juried shows when we were young, but we don't tend to do juried shows now because we have we're interested in doing the things that I think probably at some point along the way I've heard quilt makers say we want to be accepted as artists, and so I say I get that too. You know, we should be accepted as artists. So the thing is go about doing the business of being an artist, which is we try to get our work exhibited in places where artists exist. So we do business with galleries. Got early on, you know, the quilt world embraced us. So we hung out with, you know, places like being accepted. We were 28 when we first were accepted to teach at Haystack. We were really young by that standard at that time to be teaching there, and that was such an honor. And we hung out with glassblowers and potters and those who were like-minded people who cared about materials and cared about process. Painters, on the other hand, tend to pigeonhole craft separate from art. We know how that game is played. We were too young and naive to see the difference when we started out. We make that joke. We did know the difference. We chose to pursue it anyway. And there was a quest. In the 70s, there was a quest to merge high and low art. And we thought, every time we keep thinking, we felt that problem and pursued it. It keeps opening up. But ultimately, what I'm saying is we tend to put our time and energy in exhibiting our work in places where people assume they're looking at art or where they buy art. So we exhibit in galleries that show paintings on the wall next to our work instead of other quilts. And that's worked for us. And like I say, some, you know, to younger artists who are trying out, there's new venues opening up, and you try to figure out the best venue for your work, one where people are going to see it, because ultimately this is a medium about communication, and two, if you need to sell it, you've got to put it in places where the greater likelihood that it will sell will occur. So while we used to sell more with high-end craft galleries, craft galleries tend to want to take wall work and position pedestals with objects in front of it. And so ultimately, this is all about ego after all. Ultimately, the point here is that we were really happy to work with galleries where our work was on the wall, where we could, having, the way we like to think about it is, there are times to look at the work on the walls in the studio and think about it, but sometimes it's nice to go and get the work or have somebody install an exhibit where you get to go home, get cleaned up, and walk in fresh and see that body of work unencumbered by the materials and tools that you make it with. You're with your friends, you're talking to them, you're looking over their shoulder at your own work, and you get an opportunity to rethink, have a fresh eye, and it's gain, you know, because it's the work would suffer if you didn't keep it fresh somehow. And so I think that's how it's just part of growing as an artist. You need those opportunities. You need to create those opportunities. You need to put yourself in a position where people are going to say stupid stuff so that you can be dismissive of what they just said, but then think about it later. You need to do a lot of that. You need to be confident in what you're doing, but you also need to be scared to death that you're doing the most stupid thing ever thought of. So it's a little... A little bit of all of that. It's about, you know, just keeping an open mind, I think. And that's it. I think, we were educated as artists at a time when the belief is that if you work hard and everything, then what you do will add to that whole massive pile of defining humanity. And if you set yourself on the quest to do it in a way that's honest, then you know, then meaning will come from it. So I think it's not like it was we set out to change art. Maybe more it was we set out to have art change us. I'm looking for words that says that'll say that, you know, it wasn't an egotistical about ego to try to make art that would somehow make it into the history of art. It was just art that was honestly about the world as we were living in it. Where are we? What do you got?
Well, I think we're going to be done. We've been talking for 50 minutes.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
And you can, no, don't. We were wonderful.
There is stuff, and probably if you want, you can ask. I mean, there's not much here that probably makes sense now. I just have stuff about the, I mean, it's important, and probably Gail will say stuff about the collaboration, how we collaborate in terms of it being conceptual and more technical. You can ask her some simple technical stuff if that's important about the dyes and stuff. But this is fun.
Oh, excellent. Well, let's conclude. I want to thank you so much, and it is now 1:30.